You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of July, 2012, on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London. I'm Nancy Durham. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Syrian activist Malik Al-Abdi joins us for his take on the events in his home country. With some of Assad's top military advisors dead in a rebel bombing, is this a turning point for the Syrian opposition? Ethiopia's prime minister hasn't been seen for weeks. We ask the head of the Royal African Society what the country would look like without the 57-year-old premier at the helm. And coming up later on the show, we'll hear from the first Palestinian ever to qualify to compete in the Olympics. Monocle's Rebecca Collard met up with him in his East Jerusalem gym.
I have a dream to take an Olympic medal for the Palestinian people, not just to go play and come back. I want to try for a gold.
We'll also talk design with Monocle's Hugo MacDonald and hear about the mysterious death of a former UN Secretary General. And I'll play you a song or two. That's all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's get the news with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. The Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi held his first public meeting with senior leaders of Hamas today, as leaders of the Islamist group that controls Gaza came to Cairo to attend Egyptian-mediated reconciliation talks with their Fatah rivals. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, also made her first visit to Cairo since Morsi became president. After their meeting, Ashton said that the European Union hoped ongoing deliberations in the Security Council will culminate in a strong resolution that would bring the crisis in Syria to an end.
We are busy working with the countries that are neighbours to Syria, doing everything we can in the Security Council to try and get a strong, cohesive resolution, and ensuring as much support as we possibly can to the people of Syria. And of course, as the President acknowledged, there is much to do. We want to see an inclusive solution to the current parliamentary crisis and to see priority given to appointing a civilian and democratically legitimate government.
Meanwhile, rebels have attacked the main police headquarters in the Syrian capital, Damascus, today, a day after the assassination of President Bashar al-Assad's brother-in-law, defense minister and a top general. Efforts to forge a diplomatic solution have been delayed, as Russia and China have today vetoed a United Nations Security Council resolution that threatened Syrian authorities with sanctions if they didn't stop using heavy weapons and pull troops from towns. An Italian and two Spanish hostages freed by their al-Qaeda-linked captors in Mali have arrived safely in neighbouring Burkina Faso today. The three aid workers kidnapped in Algeria last October were dressed all in white as they got out of a military plane after it arrived at a base near the capital. Israel has today signalled that it wouldn't rush into any open conflict with Iran or its Lebanese guerrilla ally Hezbollah, despite blaming them for a deadly attack on its citizens in Bulgaria. A suicide bomber killed himself, five Israelis and a Bulgarian driver on a tourist bus in Burgas airport on Wednesday. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu quickly promised to react powerfully to what he called Iranian terror. Nagorno-Karabakh, Azerbaijan's breakaway region linked to Armenia by a narrow land corridor and backed financially and militarily by Yerevan, Russia's close ally, held its fifth presidential elections today. Polling stations in 274 electoral districts of the country opened their doors for around 100,000 eligible voters who will choose between four different candidates. And finally, more than 200 United Airlines passengers are back in the United States after a four-day delay in China, which resulted in a mutiny. Flight 87 from Shanghai to Newark was delayed by a day because of a mechanical failure. The next day it was cancelled again because a replacement part didn't reach China on time. Then the next day the flight was cancelled because the flight crew had exceeded their maximum flight time restrictions. Revolution was in the air as 225 passengers formed a blockade to get onto a different flight to Newark, stopping others from getting on. The passengers were moved onto an alternative flight, which was also cancelled. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you. Thank you, Jonathan. At 4 minutes past the hour, I think we just must stick to the underground.
I think it puts you off flying, doesn't it?
It really does. Mm. What an unhappy time.
Yeah, poor things.
Okay, thank you. See you again in a little bit. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Hong Kongist, Tokyoist. Sino Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Lontoosta käsin, tämä on Monaco 24.
London Bo, as a Monaco 24.
Londodan, burası Monaco 24.
Londonist, sinä Monaco 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24.
O que ni natteru no wa Monaco 24.
Αυτό είναι το Monaco 24.
Vous écoutez Monaco 24.
Das ist Monaco 24.
Du lyssnar på Monaco 24.
Kuuntelet Monaco 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24-tagare, ja.
The crisis in Syria deepens today with reports of troops mobilizing in the capital to push back rebel forces. There's been no sign of President Assad, although Syrian state TV has reported that he swore in the country's new defense minister after his predecessor was killed in an explosion yesterday. Rumors abound, one of them being that Assad's wife Asma has fled to Russia. Well, Malik Al-Abda is editor-in-chief of the London-based Syrian satellite television channel Barada TV, and he joins us on the line now. Hello, Malik.
Hello, hi.
Hi. Tell us what you're hearing today through your Syrian connections, please.
Well, the Free Syrian Army is fighting a decisive battle, as they described it. They regard the battle in Damascus now as being similar to the decisive battle that was fought by Libyan rebels against Gaddafi, the famous Battle of Tripoli that ousted Gaddafi from power. So this is how the Free Syrian Army is seeing the battle for Damascus at the moment. And actually, rebels are flooding in from different parts of Syria to Damascus to reinforce the rebel forces there and to keep the momentum of the offensive going. Now, the government forces, the forces of Bashar al-Assad, have withdrawn from other parts of Syria that are less strategically important, like Daraa to the south, where the Soul Revolution began. They've withdrawn actually an armored brigade, and they've moved it up to Damascus to bolster their forces there. So it looks like there is actually a showdown in Damascus. That battle has begun, and it's likely to go on for at least a number of weeks.
Meantime, the country outside is freed up, if I can put it like that, of some Syrian troops because they've had to be redirected. That's what you're saying.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the key problem that Assad faced from day one, which is he doesn't have enough reliable troops to control the entire country. And he's had to withdraw troops from the north and also from the east. So actually, the border crossing with Iraq now, there are no Syrian soldiers manning that border. There are also no Syrian soldiers manning the border crossing with Turkey. So those troops have had to withdraw from the extremities to the center to bolster the regime's position, because there have been the last 2 to 3 weeks, there have been huge defections, not just high-level defections, but also low-level defections as well, which has denied the regime a steady supply of troops in order to quell the revolution. So many soldiers now are simply throwing down weapons, either joining the rebels or just simply going home.
And just let's go. I want to come to Assad and where he is in a moment. But on these defections, the Syrian Free Army has an offer out to like more junior military people and regime supporters to if they leave, withdraw from their posts by the end of July, they have an amnesty. Is there any sign that that's going full tilt?
Well, absolutely. What they have said is that if anyone defects from now until the end of this month, then they will not be prosecuted, they will not be persecuted, or there won't be any legal ramifications, regardless of what they may have done in the past. So obviously, the Free Syrian Army believes that the way to victory is to get as many people to defect as possible. Now, the implications of this are, is that if you're a Sunni, you're more likely to defect to the Free Syrian Army, which is predominantly Sunni. In fact, it's almost 100% a Sunni Arab force. So if you're a Sunni and you're part of the military establishment, you're a soldier or an officer, or even part of the security establishment, then you're likely to defect or simply to stay at home. Because probably more often than not, the Free Syrian Army will not go after you, they're not going to prosecute you. However, if you're an Alawite, then I think it's a different story. You're more likely to stick with Bashar al-Assad and your own kind, if you like. And those are the people who represent the hardcore of Assad forces that are fighting in Damascus, also fighting in Homs and other areas. Okay. Those are the hardcore troops who are part of Assad's own sect.
Okay, and let's go to Assad now, though. We think there are reports that he is on the coast in Latakia. Can we verify that in any way? What are you hearing?
Well, I mean, this has been reported by from a diplomatic source. Also, a number of opposition figures have said this. Obviously, we can't be 100% sure where he is at this moment in time, although I wouldn't be surprised at all if he was in Latakia, because Damascus is no longer a safe place for Bashar al-Assad. I mean, Damascus is a place where a number of his top henchmen were assassinated yesterday morning. So, and obviously that assassination could only have taken place were not for someone who is very high up in the security establishment who actually betrayed Bashar al-Assad and his top lieutenants. So he doesn't feel safe in the capital, Damascus. Also, Damascus and the areas around Damascus are predominantly Sunni, and they're more likely to harbor Free Syrian Army. So it's a hostile environment for Bashar al-Assad. He feels safer being in Latakia, surrounded by fellow Alawites. He also has got, it's rumored that he's stockpiling arms in that region as well. So it makes sense that he's in Latakia rather than in Damascus.
And his wife, the story today is she's in Russia.
That's right. I haven't received any sort of confirmation that she's in Moscow, although it's very much within a broader pattern. We've seen how Saddam Hussein, when he was faced with a U.S. invasion of his country, he sent his wife and all female members of his family, he sent them over to Syria for protection. Similarly, when the war broke out in Libya, his family was sent to neighboring Algeria. So there is a pattern here of Arab dictators sending female members of their family abroad somewhere safe, because the last thing they want happening is for them to be captured by the enemy, which would be deemed very sort of dishonorable in Arab cultural terms.
Okay, it is difficult from afar, and I bet it's even difficult on the ground there. But, this has the appearance from a great distance of being a regime that really could crumble now quite quickly or not. Does he have it, do you think, to hold on for a while? Or is this truly the beginning of the end?
Well, it's been said so many times
Yeah.
that, this is a turning point, and it's been used sort of, this term has been used indiscriminately.
I do apologize for it.
No, absolutely. But I think this time it really is a turning point, because I think it's all about confidence in the regime or loss of confidence in the regime. And I think what yesterday's assassination, what it did was to concentrate the minds of those who are part of the regime and regime supporters. And actually now they have to think very carefully whether this regime is going to survive, because if top lieutenants of Bashar al-Assad, if his own brother-in-law and the Minister of Defense and the Minister of Interior can be assassinated in the heart of Damascus in the most secure location, then what chance do they have of winning? So Bashar al-Assad has actually carried off a very successful confidence trick for a long time. He's convinced enough people that he's going to weather the storm and survive all this. And that's the reason why so many people have stuck with him. But all of a sudden, this assassination changes all that, and he's appearing to be quite vulnerable. And I think a lot of people are going to switch sides rather quickly in the next few weeks. I mean, it's not going to be a question of days, but probably more weeks.
Malik al-Abdeh, thank you very much. Malik al-Abdeh is editor-in-chief of the Syrian satellite television channel, Barada Television. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Coming up next, we are heading to Ethiopia. Stay with us.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
All this week on Monocle 24, we get into national dress. From the monarchy in Thailand to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, we explore the history and habits behind the world's most distinctive dress. So slip into your ceremonial raiments, don your dirndls, and get ready for a special series on national dress all this week on Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House with me, Nancy Durham. Well, speculation continues about the condition of the Ethiopian Prime Minister Meles Zenawi. The Ethiopian government says he's on a doctor-prescribed sick leave after receiving hospital treatment, and apparently the story goes he's in Europe. His critics say he is terminally ill or worse. With neighbours like troubled Sudan and Somalia, the state of Ethiopia and the health of its government is indeed critical. Richard Dowden is director of the Royal African Society, and he has covered Ethiopia for 30 years. He's on the telephone line now. Good evening, Richard Dowden.
Hello, good evening.
Well, you, if anybody, should be able to tell us what's going on, 30 years coverage of this country. What can you shed any light on the condition of the Prime Minister tonight?
Well, what I'm hearing, not officially, so this is what people are, it's well-informed speculation, I think it's safe to say, from
okay.
Ethiopians. And they, what in Addis, and what they're saying is that he had an operation in the recently, almost certainly in Brussels, or a European capital, and the speculation is that he has cancer of some sort. But it's not yet life-threatening. But it must obviously slow him down and weaken him quite considerably.
Okay, and let's just have a bit of a primer here and the importance of this man to his country and this region. Could you put him in the frame for us, please?
Well, he was the guy who, I don't know how far back you want to go, but he was the guy who led the quite extraordinary uprising in northern Ethiopia, which began in shortly after 1974, when the military dictator Mengistu Haile Mariam took power, and they fought their way all the way over from 1974 until 1991, right through the country, and finally took the capital in May 1991. It was an extraordinary achievement for what was originally a bunch of students who left the capital and had grown up in a middle-class way in the capital, went back to their homeland and started the revolution. I mean, they really did do the long march.
They sure did. And he is a controversial man. He gets big points for alleviation of poverty, for some of his social policies, but he's criticized, you know, seriously for human rights violations.
Well, he and the little gang that started out in 1974 were the Marxist-Leninist League of Tigray. They were very hardline Marxist indeed, and their whole strategy was based on the old communist way of doing things. But of course, the thing that allowed them, if you like, to come to power, because Ethiopia under Mengistu was supported by Russia and the Soviet Union, and when that collapsed, that government didn't get any more arms. So what was then extraordinary was that a Marxist government, a Marxist guerrilla movement, had overthrown a communist government. And then they didn't quite know what to do, and they turned, I think, sensibly to the Americans, who embraced them and said, and then they made the deal, and he introduced capitalism to Ethiopia and led it and believed and claims to believe in it absolutely. Though in a lot of his political thinking, and you listen to him, and he sounds like a sort of an old Marxist. So it's quite an interesting transition. Absolutely fascinating. The fact is, he's not the president; he's the prime minister. But he and his little group that's still with him, and they are the core of the of the government, of the TPLF, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, Tigray being the region where they started the war. Then they built a much broader alliance. He's a very important player. Someone who's known him for some time, I'd say he's an extraordinary intelligent guy. He reads the world in a very clever way. He's very charming. He's very, very amusing. But I think his departure would be, he's not like an old-fashioned dictator. I mean, the people around him will tell him when they think he's wrong. And we know there are clashes within that central group. So I think his departure would change things, but it wouldn't mean the end of a dictatorship or something like that.
Let's look, if we could, just for a moment. We don't have so much time, but what I mentioned in my introduction, Somalia, Sudan, he's in a very difficult part of the world. How would his death, if it happened, or some dramatic change right now, have some sort of negative effect in this very shaky region?
I don't think so, unless there was a movement to rise up within Ethiopia to try and overthrow the government after Meles. And I don't think they would be able to do that in the short term. No, they are the policemen of the region, and they've got some very difficult neighbors. They've got troops in Somalia. They have a ceasefire and a sort of peace agreement with their neighbor and one-time ally, Eritrea. But that war's never been resolved. And I know that Meles Zenawi wanted to get an end with a decent peace with Eritrea, its northern neighbor, and good relations with the neighbors. But they are, you know, these guys are, this is a very, 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 very old country, not like the rest of Africa, which are new countries with old societies. This is an old society, an old country, and it has a sort of terrific power of its own, of survival, and has never been on very good terms with any of its neighbors. So I think the region will go on being a bit of a roughhouse.
Well, look, for a short interview, you've given us a very good description. Many thanks. Richard Dowden is director of the Royal African Society, and he's been covering Ethiopia for 3 decades.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
Monocle 24, yokosau.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Bruja Jalabert. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
Perhaps never before has there been so much interest in the Mormons. Mitt Romney's race for the White House has brought the religion front and center, and his acumen for business success is a daily debate. With worldwide economic concerns, questions about money and business and whether or not Romney could turn things around are frequent. Monocle's James Nelson takes a tour of the Mormon fiber. What makes them tick? What makes them successful? And how they are changing with the times.
In Moroni, Utah, you can find out a lot about the Mormons as a parade of floats depicting pioneer struggles, their artisans, and heritage showcase who they are and where they came from. This town and many others are part of the Mormon Pioneer National Heritage Area, a 400-mile corridor in central Utah where the Mormon story is perhaps best told. Each year, people from around the world travel here to find out about the Mormons. Mont Bona is executive director.
The small towns, by virtue of the architecture, the landscape, the events, and the people, are the best example in America as to how the Mormons colonized the West.
And Bona says the story found in small town Utah is part of the Mitt Romney story.
It's a significant part of the story since Mitt Romney's forefathers played a significant role in that colonization. The Romneys played a very important role in that they demonstrated the tenacity, the true grit, the character, the perseverance of the Mormon pioneer. And what the Mormon pioneer heritage is all about is not just the geography and the architecture and the landscape that I alluded to, but the character of the people. And those traits can be found in Mitt Romney, and probably go a long way toward explaining the makeup of the man's character.
Sounds of spinning reels of microfilm are a constant in the Family History Library in Salt Lake City. There are 2 million rolls of microfilm records here for visitors searching their family tree. And it's where we found Craig Foster, a researcher who co-authored the book, The Mormon Quest for the Presidency.
The Mormon moment, in my opinion, before it became the Mormon moment, was the Mormon question. And the question being, can a Latter-day Saint be trusted to be basically, if not the most powerful person in the world, one of the most powerful people in the world? Can a Mormon be trusted to be president of the United States? And my opinion is that before the Mormon question, there was the Catholic question with John F. Kennedy. Can a Catholic be trusted to be president of the United States, or would he be beholden to the Pope and the Vatican? And the same question has been asked about Mormon candidates. Can a Mormon be trusted to be president of the United States and to see to the needs of all of the people of the United States, or would he constantly be calling Salt Lake City to ask the LDS president what should be done next?
Each year, millions of people visit Temple Square in Salt Lake City. The tours are free and offered in 30 languages. The magnificent gardens and trees frame the temple, assembly hall, visitor center, and the tabernacle where the world-famous Mormon Tabernacle Choir sings. And now, right across the street, is the Mormon-owned City Creek Center, a brand-spanking new $1.5 billion mixed-use development of office space with over 90 stores and restaurants and high-rise living space, a retractable skylight roof, splendid fountains and waterfalls covering three city blocks. Taylor Randall is the dean at the University of Utah David Eccles School of Business.
You look at the Marriott Corporation, the Huntsman Corporation. You look at locally in the state of Utah, the Eccles family and the generations of greatness. Many of them came from, I would say, the Mormon pioneer heritage of hard work. David Eccles himself, it's the namesake of our school, was a Scottish immigrant. He came here with nothing, learned and started 27, 28 different businesses, became, you know, industrial leader of the West, ranging from railroads to lumber mills. And when that gets in the ethic and that gets in the ethos of a culture, I think you see great role models, and everyone aspires to be like that.
Far from the small town Utah parade is the annual Gay Pride Parade and Festival held in Salt Lake City. The 2012 event attracted a huge audience and for the first time ever featured a group of traditional Mormons marching hand in hand with everyone else. It was the brainchild of Erica Munson, who founded Mormons Building Bridges.
We weren't demanding anything from the church. We weren't marching against anything. We were just marching in a positive way, standing up as Mormons for gay people. And it just seems to be time. It makes me very optimistic. We are just moving a step at a time. We can't see everything as it will unfold, but we feel like the future, I've said it before, I feel like the future is a very inclusive and happy place in the church.
I don't know if Mitt Romney is elected president, will we have our Kennedy-esque moment where, like the Catholics, we feel like we have finally arrived. I think that many members will feel that way, and yet there will be others who will still be nervous about having a Mormon as president.
I think the increased media spotlight because of Romney has showed the world that there are many, many different kinds of Mormons with many different lives, cultures, attitudes. And so, of course, there are places. There's not one kind of Mormon that's trying to fit in in the world. They're all different stripes. And I'm very glad about that.
Heritage, culture, business, and change, all part of the Mormon story. For Monocle in Salt Lake City, I'm James Nelson.
And that was James Nelson on presidential hopeful Mitt Romney's religion. In the next half hour of the program, Hugo McDonald will join us to talk about architects, and we'll chat with a judoka from East Jerusalem, and we'll also see why former UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld's mysterious death is once again coming under scrutiny. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much, Nancy. The Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi has held his first public meeting with senior leaders of Hamas today, as leaders of the Islamist group that controls Gaza came to Cairo to attend Egyptian-mediated reconciliation talks with their Fatah rivals. Syrian rebels have attacked the main police headquarters in the capital, Damascus, today, a day after the assassination of President Bashar al-Assad's brother-in-law, defense minister, and a top general. An Italian and two Spanish hostages freed by their al-Qaeda-linked captors in Mali have arrived safely in neighboring Burkina Faso today. Israel has today signaled that it wouldn't rush into any open conflict with Iran or its Lebanese guerrilla ally Hezbollah, despite blaming them for a deadly attack on its citizens in Bulgaria. A suicide bomber killed himself, five Israelis and a Bulgarian driver on a tourist bus in Burgas Airport on Wednesday. Nagorno-Karabakh, Azerbaijan's breakaway region linked to Armenia by a narrow land corridor, held its fifth presidential elections today. Polling stations opened their doors for around 100,000 eligible voters who will choose between four different candidates. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House with me, Nancy Durham. Well, a little earlier today, Monocle's design editor, Hugo McDonald, joined me in the studio for a chat about architecture in Great Britain. It's Thursday, that's the letter D, design. And so I'm very happy to welcome Hugo McDonald into the studio here. Hi.
Hello, Nancy. It's lovely to be here.
And as always, it's great for me to be here too, and great to see you to talk design. And I gather there's been a bit of a survey which shows British people are not up to it on the architectural meter.
Exactly.
But they don't know what architects do. But hey, over to you in 1 second. 85% of the people here do know that architects design buildings. Could be worse.
You're quite right. That is straight in there with a statistic that is encouraging. Let me just give a background. This is a survey conducted by YouGov for inbuilding.org, which is an online community of architects in the UK. And the statistics revealed sort of show that the British public might not really be aware of the role of the architect in British society. That is the headline. You've said quite correctly that 85% know that architects do design buildings, which is a very good start. I think the architecture community are up in arms just because the rest of the statistics are quite worrying in terms of knowing exactly how buildings are built. But I would say in response to this, actually, they get very technical, the things that they asked all the people in the survey about planning permission, about health and safety. You know, do people really ever think that architects are responsible for going around a building site and working out the specifications for the building that goes there? Do they really have to be?
And indeed, one sort of wants to say at the risk of annoying architects, well, so what? That's not the kind of sexy part of the design, is it?
Exactly.
So, but why does it matter to architects that people know how hardworking they are and how detailed their skill set is?
Well, you know, architects, and particularly in the UK, we have a sort of difficult relationship, the architecture industry, with the public. The architects feel very misunderstood. The British public feels sort of a little bit trepidatious towards architecture, contemporary architecture particularly.
Afraid of, fear of the modern building.
Fear of the modern building. This is the sort of current theme that's been going ever much, well, pretty much since the Industrial Revolution, which is when people say just the public were traumatised by suddenly big machinery, big factories and warehouses popping up all over the countryside, ruining their green and pleasant land. And they trace this as being sort of quite a pivotal moment when the British public became scared of architecture.
Interesting.
It's very interesting. And it's sort of part psychological, or sort of pop psychology, I suppose you could say. But it does point to the fact that as a contemporary architectural landscape, Britain is not nearly as progressive as many other countries in Europe or in America, or particularly in Asia, where the publics are welcome with open arms, interesting, progressive, contemporary architecture.
Where here we have a great big modern, new, exciting thing like the Shard, that pointy piece of glass in the middle of the business centre of London in the city. And there's just it's a great big running story throughout
exactly.
the nation. But it's there.
It's there. And actually, I mean, something like this, the Shard, is very good because it least opens up discussion. Everybody has an opinion. And this is what's sort of been lacking, I think, in certainly the last two decades, I'd say, where the public has been kept out of the argument. It's been of contemporary architecture. Architects have sort of only been arguing amongst themselves and not really wanted the public to sort of step up and say, well, actually, we have to live with these buildings. Do we have a say in whether we like them or not? Architects in the UK tend to be quite a sort of enclosed, snooty bunch who feel that unless you've studied architecture, you're not really allowed to have an opinion about it.
And very hence, snobby indeed.
Very snobby. And so, you know, this is my point about wanting to bring up this YouGov poll for inbuilding.org is, you know, how can architects really claim that it's the public's fault that they don't understand the role of the architect, when the architects haven't ever really let the public into their discussion?
So obviously inbuilding.co?
.org.
.org, sorry. So obviously inbuilding.org wants to change that.
Exactly.
They're opening the doors of their building.
Completely. And I'm glad that you brought up the Shard as an example, because it's not just the Shard, but the Olympic site. There's been a big transformation of the London skyline and all these buildings that we have in the city, like the Gherkin, the walkie-talkie. They've sort of been humanised with these names and these funny shapes. And suddenly people realise that actually contemporary architecture can be interesting and fun and bring very good business into the city. And that it's good and healthy. It's not just sort of big architects patting each other on the back for their creativity. That we can all benefit from it. We can all understand it. You don't need to have an architecture degree to look at the Shard and think, wow, that's an impressive structure. I'm proud to have that in my city.
Oh, that's great. So who are the inbuilding.org? Are they newbie, you know, younger newbies? They're kind of a new wave of architects.
It's a new online community. I think as with all things online, it tends to be the younger people who sort of want to embrace it and be involved in it. It's actually done very well in quite a short space of time. It's a big community. Young architects also in the UK have quite a difficult time making their voices heard, getting projects commissioned, just because there isn't enough, well, as much money as there used to be to commission young architects. Developers tend to head to sort of safe big names who they know are going to get the project done, attract publicity. So a lot of these younger architects have gone online to sort of make their voices heard and get the opinions out there that they want to show.
We don't have Alain de Botton in the room, but let's bring him in anyway. He's doing some interesting work, and has been for a couple of years anyway, to get the people, the masses, involved in experiencing modern architecture. And that sort of speaks to this
exactly.
survey.
And he, I mean, Alain de Botton is a wonderful voice in the architecture industry in the UK because, for starters, he's not an architect. So he doesn't talk in big, sort of lauded technical terms that scare people away. He talks in very human terms about the possibility of contemporary architecture and how the public really needs to be let into the debate. So he has Living Architecture, which we have spoken about on the Monocle Weekly before, and we've had Alain write stuff in Monocle for us as well, which is a project where he's commissioned contemporary architects to build houses that are quite experimental in form around the UK that anybody can rent and go and stay in for holidays, so that they are living in contemporary architecture. It's sort of a demystifying process.
I just was looking at a picture of something. It was like a train carriage sticking out over
the balancing barn.
Is that what that is? The balancing barn?
It is. It's cantilevered over a big slope. And it's
an experience.
Exactly. And it's had a fantastic response, his Living Architecture project.
Our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, chatting with me just a little earlier. You're listening to Midori House, and we'll be right back after this.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture, from the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
What Cannes is to film and Venice to architecture, the city of Arles is to photography. Our Monocle film crew headed down to the south of France for the opening week of the Rencontre d'Arles, the world's leading photography festival.
Photographers love a group hug. There's a lot of talk of apertures and shutter speeds and white balance in bars and parties across town. Everyone's at it, shooting everything in sight. Everyone's got their eye on everything and how everyone else might be framing it for a shot. It's a life through a lens in Arles.
Monocle Films. Focus on photography on monocle.com.
And at 40 minutes past the hour, it is time for some new folk pop music from where else but Iceland. And the song that I'm going to play for you is Mountain Sound, and it is by a group called Of Monsters and Men. Mountain Sound by Of Monsters and Men. The time is now 18:44, 44 minutes past the hour here in London, and you're listening to Midori House. In case you haven't heard, this month the world's top athletes will descend on London for the 2012 Olympic Games. They're going to compete to bring home medals for their countries, or at least that's the case for most of them. Some of the athletes attending this year don't have an official country. Among them is Mahar Abu Rumela, a judoka from East Jerusalem and the first Palestinian to win his place at the Games on merit. Around a dozen Palestinian athletes have competed in the Olympics, but previously they've all attended because of wild card invitations from the International Olympic Committee. Monocle's Rebecca Collard visited Mahar in his East Jerusalem gym to find out what challenges he faces as a stateless sportsman.
In a small, poorly equipped East Jerusalem gym, Mahar Abu Rumela crouches low to the ground. Shifting side to side, he dives forward, flipping over his opponent onto the well-worn mats. Mahar is training for the upcoming Olympics in London. He is the first Palestinian athlete to earn an Olympic spot with skill. While Palestinians have competed previously through special invitation, the judo player is the first to participate on merit. He won his place by beating Hong Kong's competitor at the World Judo Championships in Japan.
Since I learned I was going to the Olympics, I've been training 6 days per week, 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the afternoon.
Short with a stocky build, Mahar will compete in the under 73 kilogram judo class in London. At the El Coot Sporting Club, he practices with players of all shapes and sizes. The challenge, says his coach, is finding skilled enough sportsmen to challenge Mahar. Mahar drops to the mat, performing a series of fast-paced push-ups.
I have a dream to take an Olympic medal for the Palestinian people, not just to go play and come back. I want to try for a gold or maybe bronze. I want to make something.
But for the stateless Palestinians, the Olympics signify more than just excellence in sport. In the opening ceremonies on July 27th, Maher will carry the Palestinian flag. While Palestinians may not have a state, they will compete as a nation. When the practice ends, Maher rushes behind the curtain and changes into jeans and a shirt, before quickly moving to Jerusalem's Old City, where he still tends the family scarf shop. As we walk through the narrow stone alleyway, Maher's brother jumps out from a small stall with a newspaper and points to an article and picture of Maher on the second page. Many of the shopkeepers yell words of support as we weave our way through the crowded market. Maher's cousin, Ala, has been watching the shop during his training sessions.
I'm happy to give him all the help he needs. I want to support him, not just because he's from my family, but also because it raises the status of the Palestinian nation.
Despite the games being only weeks away, Maher is still working in the shop in the mornings and the evenings. The customers who stop to haggle over 2-pound scarves seem to have little idea they're speaking with Palestine's first Olympic hope. Leaving Maher in the shop, I head to Ramallah to catch up with Hani Halabi. Hani coached Maher and is a member of the Palestinian Olympic Committee and the head of this year's mission to the London Games. He's excited for Maher's achievement, though is quick to point out the challenges of occupation and displacement faced by Palestinian athletes.
We have one Palestinian athlete coming from Cairo. He's a refugee. He doesn't have any passport. And another from Nablus, in the north of the West Bank. One from Gaza, another from Bethlehem, so they cannot reach Jerusalem, and Meir is from Jerusalem. They cannot meet each other even. The first time we will meet together will be at Heathrow Airport.
The economic challenges are prohibitive as well, says Hani. Many Palestinian athletes train in substandard facilities. While most Palestinian judo players live in East Jerusalem, the equipment and facilities they use do not meet international standards. And, like Maher, most athletes must balance work and training in advance of the games.
The Palestinian Authority should have provided Meir with money, but you know the whole authority is suffering a financial crisis. It's the middle of the month and they are not paid wages to government employees. But even the idea of a special athlete, getting them a salary so they don't have to work, is still a matter of culture.
For Hani, Maher's accomplishments show the steadfastness and commitment of Palestinians living under occupation. Maher is an inspiration to many Palestinians. But to excel, says Hani, Palestinian sportsmen need freedom and independence. For Monocle in East Jerusalem, I'm Rebecca Collard.
And Rebecca was talking with Maher Abu Ramela, the first Palestinian to qualify to compete in the Olympics.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Hong Kong, ish Tokyo, as a Monocle 24.
Welcome to Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, Μπουρσέ, Monocle 24.
London, στο Κασίν, τämä on Monocle 24.
London, Bo, as a Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, Μπουρσέ, Monocle 24.
London, ist, sino Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que é que você está Monocle 24.
Isso é o Monocle 24.
Você escuta Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24-tagat, ja.
It has been nearly 51 years since the then UN Secretary General's airplane crashed in Zambia. At the time, it was Northern Rhodesia. Dag Hammarskjöld was on a peace mission to the Congo when his plane came down in a forest. All but one aboard the aircraft died. Now an international commission of jurors is to examine new evidence. Three previous attempts to get at the truth have failed and conspiracy theories continue to swirl around. Well, joining us now is British lawmaker and former trade unionist Lord David Lee, the head of an international committee commissioned to reinvestigate Hammarskjöld's death. Welcome, Lord Lee.
Good evening.
What a task. What does it feel like to be taking on something, a case like this, 51 years old nearly?
Well, 2 points that arise from your question. One is that I'm the chairman of the enabling committee, which is a sort of preparatory committee to, as it were, get the commissioners to agree to a remit, and then the commissioners will take it from there. And they are doing it because the UN decided at the end of their own inquiry in 1961 that if the evidence was found to warrant reopening the UN inquiry, it would be presented to the UN pursuant to a resolution of the General Assembly. Sorry to be technical about that, but I'm the chairman of the Enabling Committee, and the chairman of the commissioners is a man called Sir Stephen Sedley, and there's a commissioner from Sweden, one from South Africa, and one from the Netherlands. So they will be then taking on the job. We're doing the announcing. It's being set up, and we've got to provide the funds, and we're putting out this statement.
I've got you. Okay, but do you think, it is technical, but I did follow you. Could we talk a little bit about, you know, this, it is a big challenge, isn't it, for someone to take on? And so many years later, I'd be the first person to say it's never too late. But how are they going to get to the bottom of this, do you think, after so many decades?
Well, in some senses, it's more difficult. But in some senses, it's possibly easier because country after country has 30-year, 40-year, 50-year rules about archives and an enormous amount of stuff, which people thought lay there, you might say, unsuspecting if anybody wanted to scrutinize it without naming the names of countries. You can imagine all sorts of countries where people might want to get their archivists to dig stuff out and so on. So that's one point. The other point, if I can put it the other way around, is people are still alive. I mean, I'm still alive, and I remember when I was at Cambridge University campaigning on this. Now, this is not a political campaign, but this is to get at the truth. And we have a Berlin Wall, Chinese Wall, call it what you like, between the people that want to see this matter re-examined and the commissioners themselves are very, very senior jurists in the highest courts in each of these countries. And so they will then take on the job of scrutinizing the evidence, and they will have to reach a conclusion as whether the new evidence is such that they think they will advise the UN to reopen the file. That's their job. And I hope within 8 or 10 months that is what they will report on.
Well, it's great to hear your own personal connection with the case back in the 60s, I guess, at Cambridge. And at the time, do you recall, what did you think the truth might be? What did you think might be being covered up?
Prejudices are not relevant to today, but of course, let's put the matter neutrally. There were and still are different interests in the mineral wealth of the Congo, to put it like that. And, of course, this is a part of the Congo right next door to what was Northern Rhodesia, now Zambia. So everybody knows that almost every country in the world has some interest in what you might call the governance of those countries in Central Africa.
Okay. I would like to just, maybe you'd like to say one thing, reading about Dag Hammarskjöld, a little bit before my time, I was a child, but he was really a very distinguished UN Secretary General, well-liked. Some people think he was the best one we've ever had. Could you say something about him?
Well, that's what President Kennedy said. Funnily enough, last year I was doing something in Sweden, and I went to Uppsala to visit his grave, and it's where the university is, and it's the old royal capital of Sweden. And I felt very touched by the fact that Sweden's had two or three tragedies, but this was in some sense a great tragedy, and felt very deeply, and it's emotionally very raw still for all our friends in Sweden. And I hope that this is going to get to the bottom of it, and I think that is a job which commissioners of this caliber would not have taken on if they didn't think they could.
Lord Lee, Lord Lee, thank you very much. I wish you all the best pushing this forward. British lawmaker Lord David Lee, that's all we have time for today, and I'd like to thank our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, our researcher, Carolina Dubanek, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Up next, after the news, is this week's episode of The Urbanist. In 3 hours' time at 2200 hours here in London, Chloe Potter and Andrew Muller will be here with the Monocle Daily. Robert Bound will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. I'm Nancy Durham. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye for now.